Welcome to Fresno Landia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom.
One small announcement before we get started here. Donnie and I will be taking the next 3 weeks off as we are entering our spring fundraiser season. We also have an amazing event coming up on April 22nd about the high-speed rail, which you should consider registering for. And finally, I'll be doing some traveling during this time. We will see you all on April 29th. We also have a favor to ask of you, our valued listeners. Fresno Landia is almost 9 months old. We're approaching a year, and we want to get feedback from you about what you like about the show, areas where we can improve, and anything else you'd like to tell us so we can make the best show for you possible. In the description to today's episode, we have a brief survey for you all to fill out to help us understand how we're doing and what the show might look like going forward. So please fill it out. It would mean a lot to us. Thank you so much.
So we have officially launched our spring fundraising campaign at Fresno Land. For those of you who don't understand, we are a 501c3. We are a nonprofit. Our existence, our 9-person team, is entirely funded thanks to our readers, our donors, and philanthropy. And all of the money that you guys give back to Fresno Land goes directly into reporting, very little overhead. So we're trying to raise $20,000 by the end of April. Every donation counts, $5, $100, $50, whatever you can give. So I would encourage you to go to fresnoland.org/donate and make your contribution today.
So today we've got some headlines, Donnie. We finally have resolution on the D5 race. Good God, it took so long.
It really did. And Brandon Vang has officially won District 5 for the Fresno City Council, representing Southeast Fresno. I believe 9 votes were all that it took to put him over the 50% threshold to win outright.
And 9 votes.
I know.
That's
truly
crazy. Which, when you look at it from a democracy perspective, local elections are where you can your vote
truly
really matters. And so it's so important. And yet most of us only show up for the national ones. And so reminders to vote locally.
Yeah, exactly. We also had another story this week from Giselle Medina on our team about a Muslim school in Clovis. It's a private school that is trying to expand, and they're hitting some literal roadblocks around traffic and safety concerns. And just
what are those? What are they concerned about?
The school is substantively expanding their square footage. They're not quite doubling, but it's near a doubling. And you have a lot of the standard resident concerns around traffic safety, making sure that the lights are working and the roads are wide enough.
Okay.
So this is not, just to be clear,
it's not NIMBYism.
It's
exactly, or is it adjacent?
So that was one of the questions we had. Is a Muslim school in a community that
looking for excuses or whatever?
Is this a typical NIMBY thing? And so Giselle asked the school organizers if they thought that was under the surface here, and they said no, they don't think it's a part of the equation. Even as we're seeing a lot of anti-Islamic hate across the country, they did not seem to think that was the issue. And we will say, as someone who's been watching development across Fresno and Clovis for the last decade plus, it's not uncommon for projects in Clovis in particular to get snagged over traffic. Mm. And there was a school expansion in Fresno near the zoo that also had some traffic concerns. So there is some, in some cases, legitimacy to those claims, and they have to work through the system.
How will it be resolved?
So the city council has yet to bring it back. They're trying to resolve a lot of these issues behind closed doors before they schedule another hearing.
Got it. And then we had a demolition happen in Chinatown. What got demolished?
Yeah, it's the Bao on Tong building. It was a Chinese Joss house, so like a religious house in Fresno's Chinatown on F Street. It was on the local register of historic places. Really sad. There was a fire that happened at the Balwanton building a few years ago and really rendered the building uninhabitable. Okay. And so they demolished it. They're going to be building affordable housing with some of the money that the state has invested in downtown and Chinatown. So there's a positive vision, but it's sad. I toured this building when I was on a historic preservation tour a little over a decade ago with people in historic preservation from all over California. And it was like a really beautiful example of a Chinatown. And Chinatown is facing a lot of issues with high-speed rail construction and a lot of change. And it's just hard to hold on to your history if you can't take care of what you got.
Yeah, Chinatown has a beautiful history. It really was a sanctuary for so many ethnic minorities who came to Fresno and weren't accepted, couldn't buy houses in white neighborhoods. It's been with us since the 1870s and 1880s, and we do need to preserve a lot of that. How are residents responding to the idea of affordable housing going into the neighborhood?
Yeah, I think there's not a clear vision yet about what exactly the housing is going to look like. The city has said it's going to be affordable. And as anyone who's in Wonk World knows, affordable housing could be housing for teachers, because teachers and police officers in many communities are not making the level of money that are still qualify for affordable housing. It could be housing for people who are escaping homelessness. So those details haven't been ironed out yet. So people are holding their breath to try to figure out what's going to happen next.
Got it. We've covered a lot of casualties over federal budget cuts. The latest is a cultural institution in Fresno, Arte Americas. What are they facing?
Yeah, so Arte Americas in downtown had a little over $550,000 grant from the Institute of Museum and Library Services, which is a federal agency, and it was supporting a fellowship program for Latina artists, and that grant has been cut. It's one of the latest strings of federal cuts that are really targeting a lot of cultural institutions, and so there's a lot of concern in the piece that Giselle Medina reported for Fresnoland around how we build a pipeline for artists, and these fellowships like this are part of that pipeline process, and we've now lost yet another piece of that.
One of Fresno's favorite activities during the holidays is walking down Christmas Tree Lane, Van Ness Road, that follows, essentially starts from Shields and then goes all the way to Shaw. And there's beautiful lights, but there could be a change coming next year. What's the discussion right now?
Yeah, so this is such Fresno gossip, by the way.
Yeah,
I love it so much. So there was a newsletter from the Fig Garden Homeowners Association that made its way to a reporter at ABC 30. And they basically said that the neighborhood has been inundated on these walk nights during Christmas Tree Lane by street vendors. And the situation has caused a lot of harm and public safety concerns. And so they're considering pausing or getting rid of the walk nights altogether. So it's an open issue.
I'm trying to discern what could harm someone selling trinkets or snacks. What harm could result from that, other than maybe you're just annoyed by the sound of the jingle bells on the cart?
I'm curious to see where this goes. I live in another neighborhood where there's a lot of, I live in Fresno High where we have block sales every spring. In fact, they should be starting maybe this weekend or the weekend after, because it's always in April and May. And that event has also attracted a lot of street vendors. And I've seen a lot of my neighbors complaining about street vendors and safety. And on its face, there's maybe some issues, at least in my neighborhood, with people walking from the median into the street because the vendors are in the median and they're not really paying attention to where they're going and they get hit at a car. Like, those are some legitimate concerns. But I think my fear is that there's this authorization of street vendors happening and they aren't from the neighborhood and they're selling tamales and trinkets and things that...
Overly aggressive neighborhood watch groups.
Yeah.
Now, I think the only thing that's a threat is my blood pressure from chortling tahine. Beyond that, I don't suspect there's a whole lot of threats
involved. If there is tahine, I am there. So anyways, at Fresnoland, we follow a lot of issues around street vendors, so we'll definitely be covering this story in the future. On today's Fresnolandia, we have Fresno City Council member Nick Richardson, who was newly elected to represent District 6, which is Northeast Fresno, on the City Council in January. Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Why did you run for office? Let's just start there.
A little bit of masochism.
Cool.
Same reason I joined the Marine Corps. There were a lot of easier options and maybe more lucrative choices for me or paths, but especially coming out of the Marine Corps, a lot of guys want to continue flying from the aviation side of it. And I could easily have shut my mouth and gone and flown for American and made $300,000 a year and done that. But there is a drive, I think, in a lot of people to do the hard thing because it's hard. I could have easily joined the Air Force or the Army or the Salvation Army or what have you. But the Marines spoke to me for that reason. I went to military school, the hardest school in the country, because it drew me in. It was a challenge. Moving home and realizing that politically, it was going to be a 6-1 city council. And
explain 6-1
to politically. Six on the left, one on the right. And the one on the right not only was also my same political party nominally, but he represented the district where I was raised and met my fiance and went to elementary school and where my parents still live and all that. I felt not only do you need a voice in a city that's roughly half and half if you were the one of the 6-1, but also we've got 20,000 veterans who live in the city, and it's a significant population. These are business owners, and these are folks who are homeless, and they're teachers, and they're everywhere in between. And I think that every demographic in the city deserves to have a voice that they can trust, that they can go to in local elected office. And if I had those qualifications politically and with my work background, that I could speak up for my community and for my neighbors and fight for them, it was an abdication of responsibility if I just watched that go by. It was far less of a me thing and more of looking around at my neighbors and my family and knowing that they needed something that I could give them. And if I didn't even try, I was really leaving something on the table.
So responsibility, a call to something.
Absolutely.
Were you surprised when you won?
No. I'll say no. I didn't really know. I wouldn't say I was going to be surprised if I had won or if I had lost. I think it caught a lot of people off guard, and the folks who are the old guard in the city or the known political consultants or what have you, that kind of demographic, a lot of them were surprised because it laughed in the face of traditional orthodoxy of local politics. But having seen how much effort we put in, just the throngs and throngs of people who showed up to walk with us, to work with us, to make phone calls for us, to volunteer and be at our events and help us hand things out. It was very clearly an entire community coming together for this. So when that prevailed in the end, some of it was due to me, sure, but a lot of it was due to our volunteers. And seeing all the work they put in, I don't think I was particularly surprised to see that it panned out, their hard work paid off.
And just so our listeners fully understand and appreciate, so you're part of this, we would say, not anti-establishment necessarily, but you didn't run with the backing of all the labor unions. You didn't have the police endorsement or the fire endorsement or the building trades. You didn't also have the typical endorsements from the Chamber of Commerce or the developers. So you really just came in a grassroots way, so to speak, and won. And now we just had Brandon Vang. He just won today. I don't know if you saw that. Very similar. You come from the right as a Republican. He's a Democrat, but very similar approach in terms of you didn't have any of the right endorsements from labor or business or developers. Do you see that as part of a larger movement, or how do you interpret what's propelling candidates like you and Brandon forward?
Boy, I really hope so. I really hope that is how we get candidates, because during the campaign, I wouldn't let anybody do anything that I wouldn't do myself or condone. So I was very clear about my expectations. And I honestly ran the campaign, I think, the best way I knew how, which is get out there. And if you're, like Marines have been thousands of times in the past, if you're outmanned, outgunned, out-endorsed, out-fundraised, whatever, that's not an excuse for you to stop trying. And yes, I hope that this is a trend that we would see, because not only does it show some of the calcified, ossified structures of the city, right? Your Chamber of Commerce, your unions, your electeds who decide to endorse. That's not the way that people want their decisions made. But hopefully also it has a secondary effect, like we're seeing now with the District 5 race, that you don't need those things. And that shouldn't be your goal. You shouldn't be running a campaign or conducting yourself with the goal of being endorsed or with the goal of making the most money, because neither of those are the responsibilities or the prerogative of a city council member. Your job is to do the uncomfortable, to be there, to be responsive, and to serve the people who are not going to, they're not giving you a seat. You are holding something that belongs to them for a fixed amount of time. And I really hope that's a mindset or mentality that spreads and becomes more ubiquitous.
Could you explain, you've been on the council now for 3 months, and so had some time to settle in, take a few votes. How has that liberation from the old guard, if you will, allowed you to play a different role? Like, how is that showing up in specific decisions or behind the door conversations?
I'm very glad that you use the word liberation, because to be honest with you, it's very freeing. After the election and after I assumed the seat, I started getting phone calls from a lot of people who had secretly been praying and hoping for me for years. And luckily, you don't have to disclose those on campaign forms, because that'd be a lot of paperwork, apparently. But everyone wants to call and sit down and have lunch now and talk. And it gives me the ability to go in, because I don't need money for the next 3.5 years. What's it going to do? It's going to sit, right? It gives me the opportunity to go in and talk to people who traditionally have the ability, unlike most of us, to speak with their checkbook. Most of us don't have that. I don't have that. I can't pay somebody $5,000 in the hopes that they serve me better. So it allows me to go in there and talk to them and say, listen, I don't need your money. Your money's going to pass hands and get spent or saved or whatever. It's going to be exchanged and then gone. Knowledge is going to stick with me. So thank you, Mr. Developer A or Mr. Fundraiser B or Magnate C. I appreciate that you want to pay me, but I don't need your money. And frankly, I don't want it because my biggest fear is that I get up in public on the record, on the dais, and I look stupid. I don't want to look stupid. I want to look like I've studied these things up and I care about the people I serve enough to do my homework. So the best thing you can do to me is talk to me about developing. What issues are you running into? Talk to me about your experiences in the planning department or with public works or with the local economy. Make me smarter so I can do a better job at serving you. Your money is gonna speak in a way that other people don't have the opportunity to. And now it gives me the obligation and the mandate that I owe every single one of my 80,000 plus or minus 1.2% constituents in District 6 the exact same amount of dedication and care. And that's, like you said, it's very liberating. So what does it do when we have conversations? My colleagues know better than to come to me and say, this group that backed you wants this, so you better fall in line with this. They know they have to come to me and bring me a logical reason why I should help them pass something or why I should vote yes or no on something. And it's really made room for logic. It's made room for compassion. It's made room for common sense. And on the backside of that, it allows me to go to these other groups who have vested interests, this union or that union, and sit down and not have them pull the string that's in my back that they planted with a check 8 months ago, but them come to me and say, hey, listen, this is why this is best for the city. Will you help us on the grounds of common sense? It's very liberating.
I think we'd all love a return to deliberation in legislatures and in all forms. I want to ask you about District 6. What are the pressing issues there? I think there's a lot of perception outside that District 6 tends to be a wealthier community. They've got everything figured out, but you cover a sprawling district that includes the largest recreational area in the city, commercial development that's going on. So what are for you the most pressing issues?
For me is really secondary, right? What I found is that each district, albeit there's seven in the city, and people tend to see one and associate a certain demographic or certain problems or whatever opportunities there, is that really you can't paint it with a broad brush. For example, we are having this series of town halls where we're going and reaching out to everybody, and they come in and they voice their concerns, and I have subject matter experts there with me. And they'll say, hey, I have a problem. My name is such and such. I live at this intersection. And as soon as they say that, I can say, before you say anything, you're going to be concerned about this or about this. And they go, well, yeah, actually, both of those things. That's great. And that's not the kind of thing that you can look up online. It's not the kind of thing that you can hear from a friend. That comes from 2 years of walking to every single one of their houses and having these conversations and these people investing in me their trust and saying, you better get in there and do something about it, or you're the person I'm holding to account. Whether it's a trailer park or a gated community or old 1970s Bonadelli houses, every part of the district has a different lead concern. Are there things that are citywide? Of course, right? Folks are worried about small businesses. Folks are worried about the homeless issue. Folks are worried about the increased cost of living. That's everywhere. That's not specific to us. But every city block or two in District 6 has a specific concern that I've got to know, because that's their bugaboo. That is their, when they wake up in the morning and they leave their house with their kids or whatever, they go to the park, they go to work, that is the thing that sticks in their mind. And to them, that is their biggest issue. And if they are passionate about it, I have to be passionate about it as well.
Is it traffic?
Yeah, what are the bugaboos?
What are some of the bugaboos we want to hear?
Sometimes it is traffic. So let's go around geographically a little bit. Starting in the northwest, we've got in the far northwest portion of our district, we've got a little mobile home community called Woodward Bluff. It's just up there on the north side of Woodward Park. You've actually got to go into Madera off the 41 to get to it.
Oh, yeah.
Their biggest concerns are the homeless encampment that's taking place in the southwest part of where they live, in addition to some of the incursions and fluctuations to the water level of the river. That is their big thing. Folks who live just moving east along Fryant, their concern is Fryant, right? Fryant and Shepherd is arguably the most dangerous intersection in the city. And they are concerned with not necessarily the traffic backing up on Fryant, but the safety of the traffic on Fryant, whether it's turn signals or it's the stoplights, people running them, it's the speed, whatever. Everybody has their own fix to it, or some of them are cyclists, what have you. That is their concern over there. Working our way over to the east a little bit, up northeast of the district, you've got Willow and International, or Willow and Copper is our border up there. They're concerned with parking. There's a lot of new development going in there, and some of those developments are apartments, and a lot of these apartments are not allocating sufficient amount of parking to their development, which means that parking then moves outside of the development onto some of these private streets in front of folks' houses. This can be an issue when it comes to safety and crossing the street. If there are cars on both sides, you can't really see someone walking or walking their dog even, or a kid on a tricycle. So they're really concerned with how parking is going to affect them. Moving south between International and roughly Shepherd or Teague, you've got the development of infill parcels of green land that hasn't been developed. People are concerned about what's going to be built there. Some places are great for housing. Some places are great for commercial areas, strip malls and whatnot. And knowing that the right thing is going in there for the right reasons is very big on some people's list, whether it's on Lakeview and Fryant on the west side off Woodward Lake, or it's on the east side on Chestnut and Beheimer across from the water treatment facility. Moving down, you've got some other smaller issues that are a little more localized, right? You've got people traveling too fast east and west along Alluvial, which has two of our elementary schools. You've got Mountain View and Lincoln, both on that street. So we've taken some steps with Public Works to get out there and get some radar speed signs and some traffic cops making a presence.
Do you think we need to slow traffic down on Fryant?
Do I think we need to slow traffic down on Fryant?
It's a racetrack for a lot of people.
No, yep. And some folks are out there going mock Jesus, trying to set a new land speed record with that nice view to their left-hand side. Yeah. There are some drivers who, yes, absolutely. I don't think overwhelmingly speed is the problem.
What is the problem?
Bad actors always have a vote, right? Every other driver, it's like when your kid turns 16, you go, I'm not nervous about you, I'm nervous about the other drivers. There are always, my cousin was killed there last St. Patrick's Day out there on Copper, not too far from Fryant, because of a lot of factors, not to mention the person driving the car was intoxicated, but it's close to my heart. My aunt's house backs up to Fryant. I think along that entire corridor, working your way from Fresno all the way north to Copper, there is some due diligence that needs to be done as far as city infrastructure. When I was in the investigative world going around and looking at these mishaps, very rarely was the fix to the problem firing something or getting rid of the individual. That individual made this decision that caused this mishap because they existed in an environment under procedures and policies and whatever else that allowed that decision to be made unsafely. So, are you going to fix every driver? No. But from the city standpoint, do we need to be constantly revising and updating the speed, the pace, and the timing that these lights are changing? Yes, absolutely. Do we need to make sure that all the intersections that have issues with non-dedicated left-hand turns get these dedicated? Yes, we totally need that as well. Sometimes it's spacing. Sometimes it's what we see over on Chestnut and Copper, or what we see on Beheimer and Granville in that area with curbs and new adjustments to the street going in not being marked well enough. Not illegally, just not well enough, or an abrupt change to the traffic pattern there that's leading to unsafe drivers. The second one specifically was one of the factors that led to my cousin being killed. There are a bunch of fixes. The individual driver, there's only so much you can do, right? You can give tickets as many times as you want, but we also have a shortage of policing capability in the city. And it's very stark, especially as we expand out to the southeast with SEDA or up to the northeast in District 6 to the north of Copper. Northeast Policing District Station is on Cedar and Teague, and they've got roughly 16 lockers there. At any one point in time, you can expect 12 of their cops to be out. The Northeast Policing District polices everything north of essentially McKinley or Clinton down by the airport, all the way up through to the border of Fryant, and from Blackstone all the way over to Willow. That's a huge stretch for 12 cops. One of my uncles was a beat cop there in the Northeast District for years and years. He just retired. And it's almost impossible for them to react to every call about a homeless person is doing this in front of this business. There was a burglary here, but the burglar's gone. I think my car was broken into. They're doing their best to keep up with it, but to balance that with the real-time crime, the crimes in progress, and then on top of that, all the traffic issues we see, whether it's panhandlers, someone speeding, we really don't have the personnel infrastructure right now to be able to police everywhere we need to, and that's a huge hindrance as well.
So that brings me to our next question I have, which is you have this philosophy of government that you described as big tent, small government. We have a $20 million budget deficit that we're going into the budget season. And policing is often in that conversation about we have expanded our police department quite significantly. We've given raises to a lot of police officers. And that has all been a part of the expanding deficit. And so where do you think we should be looking for cuts as we try to close that deficit in the budget?
Well, it's belt tightening season, as I like to say. And this comes with some creativity because throwing money at a problem is rarely the fix to it, right? You can hire as many cops as you could try to cram 10 more cops into the Northeast Policing Station, but they're not going to have room. They're not going to have working vehicles. They're not going to have, they don't have the infrastructure in place for that right now. In the growth of the city, unfortunately, we grew to the size we needed it at the time, not the size that we would need it. This goes to policing districts. This goes to infrastructure. This goes to where the plumbing and fire stations, you name it. So looking forward and building a flexible infrastructure to include safety infrastructure plan is important. Now, right now, in the short term, let's look at creative solutions. So we have a phrase in the Marine Corps, closest alligator to the boat. You're flying the helicopter around, your boots untied, but also your tail rotor's on fire. Okay, which one of those am I going to fix first? With the fire department, for example, there's been the mentality for years that because police and fire are the vast majority of where the city's funding goes, right? And it's 60-70% of the city's money just goes to those two. Now, if more firefighters and more cops is the fix, okay, I'm willing to have that conversation. But I don't think that in and of itself is. Are you going to, we can't plant and then 20 years later pluck police officers and just have them organically made. So how do we invest in the things without just throwing money at it? Like, without just throwing money at it, that's going to help them do policing. For example, police cameras around the city.
Right.
It's well known that a lot of the police cameras around the city don't work. I've seen this personally. Now, imagine if you had cameras that did work and you could track down folks who were vandalizing or were squatting or were illegally dumping or whatever else that wouldn't require a cop to respond every time. They could catalog it and get to it when they get to it. That's an investment that instead of paying for six more cops or coming up with some new fancy logo for a new branch that's dedicated to crimes in the past or whatever, that's something that's a smaller investment that will have a benefit that will outlast and outreach just more cops. Let's look at firefighters on the other side of this. So the fire department's retirement system is currently funded at 118%. It's the only one in the country that's that high. Meaning, if every firefighter who qualified for retirement wanted to retire right then, the city could fund every single one of them and then have 18% of their retirement fund left over. It's unnecessary. And they will tell you it's unnecessary. So when I want to do something that contributes to our fire safety in the city, such as increasing the airfield firefighting and rescue capabilities or the ARF capabilities at the airport, we don't currently have sufficient staff or equipment to fight the fires that one terminal brings. Now we're about to add a second terminal to our airport, which will be fantastic, but we really won't have the firefighting capabilities for that. So we can either wait until people die and the city's stuck there holding the bag, wondering why we didn't do something in the past, or we can do something about it now. So unlike police, who are one for one, firefighters are on a 1.5 time pay for overtime, right? If we're cops and you take my shift, you make what I would have made. If we're firefighters and you take my shift, you're going to get pay and a half. If we were to lower that down, so we want to pay more for airfield firefighters. How are we going to do that? We can just come up with more money and we can bluster and rant and rave on the dais. Or why don't we say, hey, fire department, ball's in your court. We want to do this because you know you need it for fire safety. Would you rather we don't fund your retirement program up to 118%, or would you rather reduce your overtime pay from 1.5 to say 1.25, or maybe just 1-to-1? Let them make the decision. They know what's best. So why don't we let them make the decision on that? So therefore we can move that money around in what appears to be a zero sum game. Now, there are a lot of things as a city we could have been doing over the past, I don't know, amount of years I wasn't in this seat, or number of years, that could be saving us money. I'll give you another example. The Celent Arena, the whole convention center complex. Celent Arena, Convention Center, Exhibit Hall, Saroyan. They're on a plan with Pardini's currently for all of their concessions and all of their catering. That costs us over $1 million every year to pay that contract for them to come in and do it. And we don't make any money off it because the money goes to them for doing it. So if you were to allow the arena or the convention center to do their own catering or own concessions, that would be a money generator and it would be saving the city, I don't know, over $1 million a year. And that's just in that one meeting that I had because I decided to agree to a tour of these facilities. And I actually just met with them about 40 minutes ago. If I found that easy in my first month in office, it's going to take some scratching and sniffing, but we can probably look around and find at least a dozen more examples of that. That what is the reason the city would put this contract in? Probably some politician somewhere. That politician ain't me. And if it means saving taxpayers money and not having a city that's in a deficit, those are decisions I don't see as hard decisions, but debatably tough decisions that I'm here and ready to make.
What have you seen in your 3 months at City Hall as some of the third rails of city politics that people don't want to touch or talk about?
So if I had my way, city council and all elected officials for that matter, their pay would be tied to some sort of economic indicator, meaning the better the city does, the more you get paid and vice versa. So you propose the idea of tying city council member pay to exactly 2 times the median income of the city or the AMI.
So the aggregate income of the city or your individual districts?
Nope, aggregate.
Okay.
Median.
Okay.
And if I'm saying this from District 6, I freaking mean it.
Yeah.
And yeah, so if you want to tie that to like twice the AMI, that's something I would absolutely be here for. But that is a conversation that's going to get you some strange looks. People don't want to talk about that, especially in public. There are a lot of things like that. There are, when it comes to what we just talked about, the first responders, for most of the council members up there, the answer is give them more money, give them whatever they need, salute them, thank them, everything else. Somebody else who's worn a uniform, I understand that more people and more money, I think it was, what, Biggie who said it, more money is just more problems?
Yeah.
Yeah, so how about smarter money? How about smarter decisions? And that's something that, again, may not be a popular decision, but the third rail also varies person to person, politician to politician, because if it's a group or an entity who's backed you previously, you almost have an NDA with them that I will not bring up anything that may be contrary to your business interests because I'm in this position and you helped me get here. This is the liberating thing.
It has not come from Miguel, but I have heard an argument that if we want to attract people from working class backgrounds into the position of a city council member, you need to have a salary that's commensurate with what they would make as a relatively senior level government official or attorney or something like that.
To that, I would say twice the median income of the city is a well-paying job. Median income of the city floats somewhere usually just barely south of 50K.
Yeah.
Get $100,000 to do this job. That is a blessing. The second thing I would say is if you want to attract somebody who's coming to this job for the money, you're going to find yourself looking at a lot of the same problems and a lot of the same drives and goals and everything else. And the third, that's not what we want, right? That's not what I'm pushing for. That's not this kind of new, these green shoots of kind of different heterodoxy we're seeing springing up, and hopefully that I can continue to spread. And the third thing is, I know so many young junior enlisted Marines who work far more than 80 hours a week, who make far less than $100,000 a year, and they are happy that they do it. And they love it, and these are the best days of their lives. So if putting in, and I will also say, no city council member works 80 hours a week. If you combine what I do during the week and the weekends, you're probably pretty close, but they're not doing that. And the money that would go with that, again, if you're chasing the money, there are so many other jobs I would suggest someone take. This should be a job for someone who's willing to do hard stuff, who's willing to personally sacrifice their time, maybe some money, maybe some political reputation, maybe the convenience of their spouse, sacrifice those things for a greater cause.
Yeah, it's a civic responsibility. It's not, you can go work in the private sector, make what you want.
Absolutely.
But I also see the talent question is important, and people do respond to incentives, and I do believe that. So it seems like it is a difficult question to come to a direct answer on, because people respond differently to incentives.
Yeah.
You have a different response than someone else would have.
Some of the smartest, hardest working, life on their line, ride or die folks that I know, we're not in that job for money. And we're not in that job. There was no lack of talent there. And I refuse to draw a parallel between high pay and high results.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's jump to a different topic, which we've covered quite a bit recently, which is the proposed blast mine by the multinational
CEMEX
company.
Yeah.
We want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, you
on
haven't
this.
Spoken about it yet, so we'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Yes. CEMEX is, for those who are not aware, it's up in northwestern Fresno, if you will. It's actually just outside of the city limits. It's in the county of Fresno. They are the single largest granite and gravel provider in the valley. The second biggest, I think, is in like Coalinga. They had a 100-year contract to build, whether that was blasting, fracking, which we can go into later. I've done a lot of consulting on the oil and gas fields. They are also directly juxtaposed with the San Joaquin River being a vital resource, not only for the water, but also for the ecology and the natural resources of the area. So what is the grind? They have traditionally picked different little pockets where they can dig, and they dig roughly 30 to 40 feet down into the ground, and they come up with this gravel and aggregate. Once they're done mining because there's only a certain spot of the topsoil that you can mine for this stuff. It's not, you've seen the cutaways of sedimentary rock and what have you. Once they get through that, then they proof it. They level in all the tracks they were driving on, and they fill it with water, and they plant some trees. And they've done a really good job with that, to the point that my fiance and I are actually having our reception out there in October after our wedding, right there next to one of their former blast pits. It's beautifully done ecologically. Now, they want to move, and they want to move from a place that they've completed their granite and their 100-year contract is expiring. So they want to move into another piece of property that they do own. It is under their purchase jurisdiction that was given to them by Ball Ranch or something 100 years ago. So what's the conflict here? The conflict is they will be continuing what they have been doing, the impact with the environmental impact report. We've seen all this, which goes into bleeding depth into all kinds of things. But they will be continuing to use county and city roads to transport this concrete and their gravel and granite. They will be drilling a new hole, and this hole will not be 30, it'll be 60 feet deep. 600 feet deep. And then obviously there's jobs and there's the off-put from the ecological concerns, CO2, what have you. Right next to the river, there is the concern that if they dig down deep enough, they will get to a point where water will then be leached from the river, or vice versa. Concrete and their mixing substances will be leached from their pit back to the river. Now, the way they dig, if you go out there and visit their sites, is it's like an upside-down Mayan temple, right? They'll dig down 30 feet or so, and then they'll make a little terrace, and then they'll go down 30 feet or so, and they'll dig a little terrace, and they'll continue that down. One, for stability, so they can continue driving down there, but two, that minimizes the impact that it has on the surrounding area. So with this, because as soon as the folks from the river pitched it to me and they said, hey, we're afraid this is a disaster and the river is going to move and it's going to spill into there and people are going to drown and whatever, birds are going to lose their home. Once it was explained to me, I understood that what they're doing will not directly affect the river habitats. Now, that is not the end of the environmental impact report. There's a lot more that goes into it. There's noise, there's infrastructure limitations, there's traffic limitations. There are all kinds of things that go into this outside of just, will the river move or will the river be disrupted?
Which so, the Federal Bureau of Reclamation is on the record saying they are afraid of this too, the river moving. Like, it's not just the river advocates, it's also the federal.
Sure.
Yeah.
And what I do as someone who's not a river expert or a geologist, right, is I look at the environmental impact report,
yeah,
trust the experts who have put it together because they don't let CMEX do their own, right? Or they don't let the anti-CMEX protesters or what have you, or the park people or the river, mm-hmm, people do their own. It's done by experts. I look at that and we balance at the end of the day whether or not this will be a significant change to any environment. I have a lot of constituents who live up there along Fryne who are very passionate about it. Everything from plumes of CO2 making their way over to their house, or the decibel level that their dogs will be experiencing because of underground blasting that the people can't quite perceive. And I will say they've done a good job, CMEX has, at putting their seismic intrusion devices, which actually we used to deliver when I was in the Marine Corps as well, into the ground to tell whether or not the vibrations from their digging was going to have an effect on water lines, on the stability of other pieces of the ground, of the river bedrock, of whatever. So they've been doing a good job with that. This ultimately is not a city decision. It will be a county decision. So my concerns are primarily, how will it affect the city? How will it affect the people who rely on me to make sound decisions? So this means my biggest concerns are, we talked about Fryant Road already. They use Fryant for their transportation of these things. How is it going to affect any market that may benefit from them being there? So you think of construction, you think of road repaving and infrastructure, you think of homes going in, you think of buildings, whether it's a remodel or a new build or some of the infrastructure we're trying to build downtown. What will that look like cost-wise for the consumer, for us, for the taxpayer, when we have to go to Kalinga to acquire all these materials? Again,
isn't there just a mine across the river in Madera County? Like, why would we need to go to Kalinga for the materials?
It's not the stuff or the scale that we need.
According to whom?
According to CMEX. Okay. Because they keep tabs on their closest competitors. And if they get an order that is above and beyond what they can produce, they know where to go. And they know where to go for the cheapest alternative. They don't really advertise it, but they know where those things are. Save Mart is very familiar with the operations of Vons, if you will. So what would it mean for the citizens here, the residents, every time we're paying money into Department of Public Works or for developers to come to Fresno or what have you? Again, they didn't give me any money. I'm not making this decision because I have any love for big scale tract home developers. I'm looking at, what is it going to do for the taxpayer that is my aunt and my mom and my grandma who live in that area? If there is a disproportionate impact on them, their lives, their infrastructure, their safety, their transit to and from work, and maybe the ear pain of their dog, then I'm sympathetic to that, and I would not approve, not like I get a vote in this, I would not approve something that's going to disproportionately impact their lives. If it will make their lives cheaper, there's a negligible impact on the environment that can be proven by experts and explained to me, marine proof, right? Explained to me like I'm a second grader, then I will be much more likely to side with them at this side. The CMEX, they try to make an argument for, it's a bunch of jobs. It's really not that many jobs. Jobs is, I will be very frank, jobs is a poor argument for maintaining CMEX in its current capacity. They don't employ that many people from the city. It's not like we're losing whatever, the pipe fitters union or something like that.
Yeah.
It comes from how much is this going to raise our taxes? How hard will it be? Will people decide not to develop in Fresno anymore, thereby contributing to our already exacerbated housing crisis? What is making Fresno an attractive place to be for developers, for business owners, for entrepreneurs, for folks looking for jobs and to educate their kids and start their families? What is the impact it'll have on them? That's really my calculus going into this. And ultimately, like I said, it'll be a county decision.
Well, right. And I think it's just, you can never prove that there's going to be an environmental disaster because it's a complex system.
Until
it
happens.
There's so many variables that we don't know. And that's, I think, our big concern, at least my big concern, is that multinational companies can be as careful as they can be, but the truth is they don't have the control that they attest that they do, because you're dealing with a complex environment that has many variables at work and some that we're just not even aware of.
Exon Valdez, your deep sea horizon.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
So is the risk worth the return would be my question to you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That is a utilitarian approach to it. And I totally appreciate that.
Yeah. And I think the question that I've had, our reporting showed that the U.S. Geological Service, or was it the State Geological Service, said that we already have a 100-year surplus of gravel. So it's like, why would we take the risk if we don't need it, if our ecosystem can absorb? So understanding that, like, what are we actually doing this for is helpful.
But what you're saying is, ultimately, you're concerned about what your district is concerned about, which is roads and noise.
Correct.
Yeah, roads and noise.
If it were up to Nick, I would say find another place to get granite. I love the river, and I want to be able to ride my bike around down there without listening to construction equipment.
Yeah.
But it's not my decision. Now that I'm here in this seat, I have to understand that my priorities and my preferences really take a backseat.
So there's another topic we want to talk about. You just referenced that we have a housing crisis, and it's obviously getting worse. And there was a policy that came forward in front of the council for discussion, was it last week, the week before, around making it easier to build housing in infill areas. And you had some concerns about that. And so I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit more about your opposition to that and ways that you think that we can accelerate building more housing.
Absolutely. So being entirely intellectually honest, the bill itself was not, hey, let's make it easy to build houses. The bill was specifically, let's add multifamily residents to areas that are currently zoned for office or commercial as one of the additional allowed usages for that land, and let's make it ministerial approval. Ministerial approval just means that something that libertarians generally love, that it can be approved by the lowest capable level employee in the planning department as opposed to coming to the planning commission and having these elected or appointed officials get their greedy, political, nasty hands all over it. I love that. There are some second and third order effects, just like rent control, something that at face value, you go, wow, this is fantastic. Like, I rent now, and someone controlling how much my rent can grow up, that's fantastic. I love the sound of it. The second and third order effects of that are important, and making a decision based on the title of something is irresponsible governance. You got to dig in. So what does it do in its entirety? Yes, it allows the big sexy part of it, the part that gets most of the attention, is that we can convert currently unused office spaces or office buildings for residences. This means we put roofs over heads. This means that you increase basic economics. You increase the supply, demand will fluctuate as necessary, prices will go down overall. The more of something you build, the less expensive it is. This is housing, this is apples, this is whatever you'd like, widgets. Along with this comes a couple things. One, it not only takes those buildings and those commercial spaces that are currently unused. After the pandemic, we saw that a lot of people realized that they could run their business from home and they don't have to go into the office anymore to perform their duties, but also land before it's built, before it's developed at all, empty parcels. We have a couple. We've got a really attractive one, just this big, sexy plot in the northwest corner of First and Herndon that I would love to see turned into something like Avalon Commons, which is an affordable housing community, catty corner from me.
It blows my mind that has been vacant this entire time.
Same.
Blows my mind.
It's right next to that big kind of Spanish-looking
building. Yeah, it is. Yeah, early California.
I remember as a kid going to TGI Fridays and being like, I wonder what's going to go there someday.
Nothing. I remember the answer.
Up until about a year ago going to TGI Fridays.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
I spent every Halloween at that TGI Fridays when I was a kid.
But if Nick Richardson's king for a day and I can wave a wand, that is what I would like to see. I'd like to see an Avalon Commons, too. It's close to public transportation. It's close to commerce. It's in a great school district. It's already got the infrastructure off front to turn in there. It doesn't disturb Herndon being an expressway. It's a great place for that. I'm not king for the day, so it's going to come down to some diplomacy. But it would take somewhere like that and say, this can no longer, this now will go to a priority of multifamily housing instead of commercial. Now, places like First and Herndon, that argument can be made, right? We can make the argument that, okay, maybe this is best for housing, maybe it's best for commerce, but let's look at like where this problem is the most exacerbated or the kind of the most inflamed. We have two, arguably three, high commercial corridors in the city. One of them is Blackstone, north-south. One of them is Shaw, east-west. And the other one's Herndon, east-west. Now, let's zoom in a little bit and look at North Blackstone between Neese and roughly Alluvial. That area is called River Park. River Park brings in, for the entire county, not the city, the entire county of Fresno, just River Park, just that one block, which I'm blessed to have in District 6, that block brings in 25%, a quarter of all of the sales tax of the entire county.
That blows my mind.
It blew mine as well.
Where did you get that number?
That came from the county assessor recorder. In addition to this one, and this is a pretty well-known fact, the single largest contributor in the city to sales tax, which is vital as we're trying to run the city and not be in a huge deficit, is an industry that is, anybody? Car sales. It's auto sales. Where is the highest concentration of auto dealerships?
Palm and Herndon.
Yeah. Palm and Herndon's a good one, but that's pretty localized to just that corner.
Bullard to Blackstone.
You go about a block either direction and you run out of car dealerships after you leave Palm and Herndon. Bullard and Blackstone is huge.
Uh-huh.
That entire Blackstone corridor, all the way up until River Park, is huge. They're the single biggest contributor. So if we're trying to generate more sales tax to the city in a place that along Blackstone, for those of you who maybe aren't familiar, nobody wants an apartment, a second story apartment on Blackstone. Blackstone is not
know.
The place.
Blackstone and McKinley, people live there, and it looks wonderful.
That is not the backbone of the car dealer areas.
Because it's moved north.
That, yeah. Is, yes. That is a very different type of Blackstone.
If you were to tell someone you would build them a brand new house right there on the corner of Blackstone and Bullard, they would tell you to kick rocks.
Yeah,
right?
In the tattoo parlor. And,
exactly.
But don't you think that argument was made when they built the housing on Blackstone and McKinley? Who in their right mind would build housing next to a bunch of used car lots and...
I can't speak for what that conversation looked like, but what I can speak to is we have areas around the city very clearly that are residential neighborhoods, and they're residential for they're residential because the emergency services are used to it. They're residential because the public infrastructure, the utilities, the electrical and the water and everything is used to it. The folks can leave and they can within a mile be at their school. And then we have areas like Blackstone, which are very clearly commercial. Like we just talked about that River Park and that Blackstone area is vital to the city and our ability to maintain incoming taxes that alleviates the individual homeowner and taxpayer or renter from paying extra taxes because we're able to get it through the sales of desired goods.
So you may not know this. I'm an urban planner. So like mixed use development is everything, right? So think of Santana Row in San Jose. Shopping mall, very successful, has lots of housing next to it. People can walk to the stores. Why can't we incorporate more of
that? Yeah, what would we need to do to Blackstone to make it like mixed use attractive?
It would have to be planned that way in the beginning.
Okay.
So I used to...
But that's just not how cities evolve. They change over time and you have to adapt the uses as you go.
See, I would disagree to an extent because when I think of the perfect mixed use area, the perfect mixed use, say downtown or locality, I think of the place where I lived with my dad when my dad lived in Germany when I was a kid. This town was built in the 1400s. Downstairs was a restaurant. Upstairs, it looked like Beauty and the Beast. It was cobblestone roads. We lived there. There were like two or three stories of apartments. It was great. We'd walk out. We could walk to anywhere we wanted in the city. It was right there. It was accessible. The birds whistled in the morning. You could smell the brewery a block away. It was fantastic. Now, this town was built before cars. It was built before horses and carriages were even widespread. It was built in like the 1400s. Beautiful city. That said, it operates perfectly because it was planned for everyone to be able to walk to all of the vital resources that they needed and it's not four-lane roads. In fact, you can't drive cars through the majority of downtown Lish, if you ever go to Lish. Knowing what we have, knowing that we have Blackstone, again, I've been in this job for 3 months, knowing that we have Blackstone that is able to provide what it does economically, we know that we can go there if we're a consumer looking for a certain service, and knowing that it is not where all of the residents in our city have currently petitioned and begged to have their residence, we have to be able to use it for what it is. We have to be able to use a hammer for a hammer and a screwdriver for a screwdriver. If we do that effectively, yes, I would love to have somewhere that looks like, whatever, Five Points in New York, where you can walk around and everyone's kids are playing in the fire hydrant and J-Lo's walking down the street, everyone gets along. But Blackstone is not that.
Could we have something in between those things? You know what I mean? Like some kind of version that's, we're not going to recreate Greenwich Village here. We know
that. That's absolutely what we can do. And that is where we should be putting our emphasis when we develop these new areas like Seda or up to the north, or like they've done honestly a decent job of it in Madera with Tesoro Viejo. We have some friends who live up there and the kids can walk to school and they've got their little barbershop and they've got a whatever. And because they put the foresight into planning. When you have a city that develops, and again, I'm going to abdicate here to the expert, but as you have a city that develops with kind of this weird growth, urban growth system that Fresno has, it's hard to go back in time and then replan and start over.
I'm going to have to bring you to some planning conferences. So you should talk to the planners in San Jose, LA. Like, this is the work of urban planning in the 21st century, is taking cities that had these growth models that entirely oriented around the car, around fast travel, and then thinking about how we rehabilitate them to be more walkable. And
I would love that.
We should totally talk offline because that's a whole fun journey to go on. And not everything that they do in San Jose or in LA is going to work in Fresno. And I think that's the journey that we're going through. And so I live like on the southern, off the southern part of Blackstone, where the transformation is happening at Shields and at McKinley. Mm-hmm. And it's awkward, right? Like, it's not going to be perfect. And it's certainly not how Blackstone was planned. But cities have to evolve over time. That's just going to be my
Well, and it's a libertarian view, right? That's this idea that communities create the environments that they need and want.
Yes. It's either you craft the perfect tool because you know the job that needs to be mm-hmm. done, or you adapt the tools that you have to try to get the job done.
We conclude each of these podcasts by sharing what we're loving this week. Donnie, Nick, does anyone want to go first?
Go ahead.
Mine is a bit unhinged this week.
Go for it. Do it.
I was with some friends this week drinking canned margaritas, which is never a good idea. So don't do it because the alcohol content is way too high. But I have this secret idea that is not secret anymore because I'm explaining it on the podcast. But I really want to start a business where I fix, rehabilitate old windows and doors. I live in a historic house. My house is 101 years old. And the city has this grant program where they'll pay you to, if you live in an old home, to fix your windows and doors so that your house looks historic. And I was like, oh, this is so cool. The city has this program. Let me find some contractors. Hey, city, who's the contractors that do this work? And they were like, no one does this work. So then I had this idea, even though I've literally never done it before, I'm going to start that business. So anyways, this is totally never going to happen, but I did a lot of business dreaming over margaritas this weekend. That was really fun.
That's fantastic. Nick, what are you loving this week?
I'm going to get weird and esoteric here, but
do it.
I am loving the Arabic language this week.
Oh,
next week I'll be leaving for about 3 weeks for a Marine Corps mission in Northern Africa. I go out there. A lot of the countries we're working with speak French. I'm a French interpreter for the Marine Corps, so I can get along with most of them.
Where are you going?
Tunisia.
Oh, I've been to Tunisia. I love Tunis. Okay. I love Carthage. I love ancient history. It's a great place to tour. Yeah. I love it.
But as a sign of respect, in addition to the French that I can get by almost anywhere there, I have been dedicating myself to learning Arabic, and it's frustrating. They remove the vowels from a lot of the words, but it's really a beautiful language. It's a challenge for me, and I'm really looking forward to I've been diving in very deeply lately, especially this week, and I'm looking forward to putting it to good use.
Do you practice it?
Usually alone, so no one can make fun of me as I mispronounce stuff.
Do you use books or software, or what do you do?
There's an app that I use to learn any language that doesn't use our same alphabet. So I've used it for Korean, I've used it for Japanese, Russian, and now Arabic. It's called Drops. This is not sponsored.
Oh, I love Drops. Drops is great.
Drops is a fantastic app. It's especially good for Korean because it makes you draw the letters and it's great.
Oh.
But yeah, Drops is fantastic. I've been just diving in, hitting all my numbers and everything daily, and really getting an appreciation for the sound and the culture of the language.
Fantastic. I've got, let's say, a nerdy one and a lowbrow one. So my nerdy one to start, I read a lot, and This week, I'm very excited this month. There's a historian named Tom Holland who has a great history podcast, but he's also a prolific writer. And he's coming out with a new translation of The Lives of the Caesars, which I love a new translation. I'm the guy that pre-orders the new Iliad translation that's coming out.
Wow.
And I'm very excited for this one, because if you've never read The Lives of the Caesars were the wildest, most interesting people, oftentimes awful, always fascinating, and I'm looking forward to Tom Holland's translation of Suetonius. On the flip side, I love NBA basketball, and we're about to get NBA playoffs. Last night I watched the Warriors and the Lakers play, and that was a lot of fun watching Jimmy Butler and watching Luka Doncic face off, and Warriors took it, to Donnie's pleasure.
Yay,
and I'm just excited for NBA playoffs. Is the best time of year. I really love it. There's games, you can just jump into any game during the week and it's a lot of fun. So that's what I'm loving. This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.